Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Welcome to the Symposium of the Lotus Eaters. Today we're joined by Bo, and we're going to talk about historical inevitability and if there is such a thing or not, and whether we have reasons to believe in it or not. But it is a concept that plays a lot of role in people's minds nowadays. And very frequently, history is something that is very difficult to get into. And I think that one of the ways in which we feel a bit more productive and we feel that our awareness of history is increasing is by noticing patterns. But it's a very large question whether these patterns are patterns that are heuristic or patterns that are basically realities. And whenever we talk about inevitability and necessity, I think we're making some metaphysical claims. So I think we should have a general conversation about what is history, what is its link to understanding, how we can view different views of explanation and how they create different views of history, and then talk a bit about the narrative of infinite progress and also the narrative of infinite decline. And just, I want to hear a lot what you have to say about it and see where we are going to end up. So what is so fascinating about history? Why do we read it?
Gosh, well, that's a big question, isn't it? Some people hate it, don't they?
Yeah.
Lots of people say, oh, I hated doing history at school. I knew a guy I used to work with, a South African guy once, who said he hated history. He'd see me reading some history text at lunchtime or something. Say, why are you doing that? Why are you wasting your time with that? That's got no relevance to our world, our life. I mean, you couldn't be more wrong, of course. Yeah. The present is a product of the past. You can only understand the present by having an appreciation of the past. Cicero said, didn't he, to be ignorant of your past is to forever remain a child.
Yeah.
Something along those lines, obviously, that's in translation. But it's fascinating to me, but it isn't to everyone. But I'm sort of endlessly fascinated by history. I said somewhere else on one of the other epochs that it has to be extremely boring bit of history before I sort of turn off. But I think that there's nothing more interesting, really. Quite often, a lot of the time, history is more fantastic than fictional stories, more wonderful in a way. But one thing I'd like to say about this conversation, what we're going to have, just to make it clear to begin with for people who might not know, is that there's history itself, i.e. the events, and it's always a struggle to agree on what those events were, even really recent events, even very well documented events. The past is sort of profoundly lost to us. Every moment that passes into history is profoundly and forever lost. You can sort of immediately argue about what just happened, what we just saw, let alone things that are centuries or millennia ago. So there's history, there's the study of the events. And then there's historiography, which is the study of how we look at those events,
yeah,
or through what lenses are we looking at those events. And what I did at undergrad anyway, I did ancient history, not modern history. And that is very sort of historiography heavy. You look at the ancient historians themselves as much as the actual history. So that's a big part of, if you get into historiography, if you get into just history deeply, is you have to look at not just the events, but who's telling you about those events. And what are their motivations and biases and all sorts of things? And as you say, and then there's sort of another level where you can talk about patterns and if there's an inevitability to things. So it gets metaphysical really quickly. Is everything already predetermined? Are we just running through the motions or not? Do great men of history matter all that much? Or is it more just general trends, just the march of history that sort of class and race and things, what determine everything, not individual people and what they said and did?
I think what you said raises too many questions. And that's a good thing. So let's start with the least important one.
Okay.
Because you mentioned that someone you knew in the past found history boring. I think that when people say this, they have in mind a particular kind of history writing that is too much focused on particular details. And people forget, they don't see why this is interesting. So for instance, if we just have a history book that tells us about, let's say, a particular shop in the Middle Ages, maybe some people would find that completely boring. And they say, okay, I don't care. I don't care how many beers they sold that day and how many beers they sold the other day. But what could be more interesting was to show how, for instance, the way I see it, show how this relates to a wider culture and show how, for instance, that sort of, let's say, establishment was affected by its culture around it, and also how it could show us a glimpse of how people lived in the past. But when it shows us a glimpse, it seems to me that it is somehow appealing to some universal themes. We care about, for instance, how we would be if we lived in that era. This is one thing that I find particularly interesting. So it seems to me that interest and lack of it have to do with the extent to which we find ourselves in something, whether we think that it expresses us or we think that it gives us a glimpse of how we could be or how we would live if we lived in another era and another society at a different time and place, or in our society at a different time. And also I think that this is something that it helps us understand ourselves better somehow.
Right, yeah, absolutely. I think that's what it's all about. Well, for me anyway, I want to understand the world I live in. I want to understand people. I want to understand myself.
So how
and you can do that by reflecting on history.
So let's be a bit more, let's say, detailed in how this happens, because I agree with you. I think that history helps us to understand ourselves better, other people better, our societies better. It helps us understand people. And it's also linked with a sort of memory. And let me give an example. I think there is a movie called Memento with Guy Pearce.
I've seen that, yeah.
He loses his memory. Mm. And he is tattooing his body to remember events. Because it is a form of historiography for him. Because he is trying to establish some events, the memory of some events, knowing full well that he may forget them. So this enlargement, let's say this, and this, how should I put it? This focus on memory creates a sort of identity. And I think that history could be seen also as a form of establishing a sort of collective memory.
Right, yeah.
Like the history of a family, the history of a town, like Machiavelli was writing about the history of Florence, the history of a nation, like Hume was writing about the history of Britain. And also we could have also a history that is transnational, that is talking about, you know, humanity in general, or Europe, or Asia, or Africa. So how does it work? How do we see ourselves there? How is our understanding of ourselves increased by history?
Right, yeah, I mean, one of the first things I'd say is that it's always going to be a narrative. It's not a perfect story, by definition.
Yeah.
As I say, there's sort of, when you really drill down into it and you get into sort of the philosophy of history, you become sort of, as I say, sort of almost metaphysical quite quickly. You realise that there is no objective truth of the past.
Yeah.
And so, once you accept that, at least it's to various degrees, you can agree on that. But if you accept that, then it's always going to be a narrative. It's always going to be a story. It's always going to be a construct, not the actual thing. It'll always be a reconstructed thing. So now already you're into the weeds, right? You're already into some difficulties right away.
Yes. When you say that there is no objective fact of the past, do you mean that basically every fact about history or every event that historians talk to us about is an event that we cannot be certain about it,
yeah,
and that a lot of, let's say, a lot of their limitations create limitations for us. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, well, especially,
I want to understand what you
mean.
Yeah,
especially if you're trying to build up, as you put it, like an identity.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of sort of the identity of nations, say, the history of Britain, let's say. It's always going to be a constructed thing. It's not just like an objective truth that you're talking about anymore. There's one anecdote I really like. It was of Sir Walter Raleigh. He was in the Tower of London at one point, and he saw some sort of altercation, some event outside his window that he wanted to document. And he wrote it down, and then he asked the few different people, the handful of people that were actually involved in it, and he asked them for their account. And they were so divergent. He got such different accounts of people that took part in a very, very recent event that he said, I can't remember the exact line, but he said something like, I despair for history.
Yeah.
Like all history must be some level of a confused nonsense if we can't just agree on what just happened.
Okay. Now, I want to ask you about something you said about the construct before, because I want to understand what you mean, because there could be all sorts of interpretation of this claim. So when we, for instance, now talk here about constructivism, we frequently have in mind something like relativism or subjectivism, where you say everything's a social construct and there's no reality, things like that. But there is another view that says that when we saying that something is a construct, it means literally that it is written by humans, that they're fallible beings, which doesn't mean that there is no objectivity, but it could imply that, you know, there are limitations and playing of human beings playing into it. And we are talking about fallible human beings that could make mistake. But that doesn't mean that they're not talking about an objective domain of facts. So when you're saying that history is a construct, or I don't know if I'm paraphrasing or something, do you have one of these two notions of a construct in mind? Is it a third?
I mean, you could call it subjectivism or something like that.
Okay.
But I think that it's very difficult, if maybe impossible, to arrive at an objective truth about the present.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
We can't really, and we're taking it to the nth degree here, but we can't really agree that we're both experiencing the same thing in the present.
Yes.
So it's an impossibility to do it for the past, which, as I say, every moment that goes by is profoundly lost. You can never go back and revisit it.
I
mean, we are taking this to the nth degree. You can also, though, of course, agree on what you think is going on in the present or in the past or has happened in the past. You can also sort of agree. I can't remember who the quote is. I probably should know exactly who the quote's from, but it's that history is a set of facts agreed upon.
Okay.
That's one way of looking at it. I think that's a fairly helpful way of sort of thinking about history. It's just a set of events that most people have agreed was the most likely thing that happened.
Yeah. Okay. No, I see. I think I see what you mean. One question here is the question of disagreement about the present, because disagreement is pervasive about almost everything. Especially if you read some philosophy, you'll see that philosophers even trying to find a way to disagree even about the obvious. Mm-hmm. But you're entirely correct that we don't even agree about the present. And I think that if we look at why we disagree about things, we will see that we view things from a sort of limited perspective. We do not have a God's eye view of the universe. Okay. And we are also fallible beings. We're not infallible. So there comes a question as to what sort of intellectual traits we need to have if we are honest about ourselves and our limitations and about our pursuit of history. Because there are all sorts of motivations why people read history and they appeal to history. Some of them, they want to say, okay, I really want to understand. As we said before, I want to understand myself. I want to understand my society. I want to understand my family or my parents and the kind of society they grew up in, the kind of values they had, and that by implication, the kind of values that affected my upbringing. Or also, You could say I want to read history because I want to see where the future will take us, or make an informed judgment about what is probably the case, what will probably occur. But there are also people who read history and appeal to history for more nefarious purposes. And even if they have, let's say, a good reading of history, they may apply it selectively, and they may, let's say, talk about some events while withholding others. They may, in purpose, put forward a very selective view of history. So I think we should ponder a bit on our fallibility, because there are historians, it seems to me, and this isn't just historians who do so, it's people in general, who really don't like thinking that they are infallible, that they are fallible. And I think that this creates a lot of problems. So what is the importance of understanding of fallibility for reading history, and how does this increases our, let's say, understanding of the historical process? How does our understanding of our fallibility help us understand, let's say, different historians?
That's an interesting question, interesting thing to think about. Well, I would say, I think, that the pursuit of sort of infallibility is obviously doomed.
Yeah.
It seems to me. I mean, perhaps in science it's a bit different, like a mathematical proof. I'm no mathematician, but I understand you can have a mathematical proof of things. And you can say to an extreme level of certainty, if not absolute certainty, that something is or isn't the case in maths and maybe physics and things. But when it comes to history, you can't do that. It's not possible to do that. But people have tried.
Yes.
Haven't they? Absolutely tried. They tried to reduce history to a science. Well, in my opinion, and most people, if you're honest, you can see fairly quickly, fairly easily, that that's sort of an impossibility. So that's what I would say. And I also, I've said a number of times that I'm sort of quite a fan of Socratic thought, and the idea of being cognizant, being aware of the limits of your own knowledge, and you know, be a little bit humble. Don't think that you're infallible.
Yes,
and don't really even strive for it exactly, because that way lies madness or something. That way you will be frustrated and fail. And those that think they've got there are they've built an edifice in their own mind on foundations of sand.
Yeah,
I think.
Exactly. I think we'll get there in a bit, because what I think is really important is to remember our own fallibility and also to be aware of our own ignorance.
Right, yeah.
And there are many things that we do not know, and it's very healthy if we accept to ourselves, I don't know about this.
I've got a little anecdote once when I was younger. I would quite go around friends' house and things, and watch the History Channel back when it used to be good.
Yeah.
Whenever it was up to me to change the channel, I'd nearly always put it on the History Channel and watch World War II documentaries and things. And I remember one of my friends saying to me once, why are you constantly watching history things? You can't know everything.
Yeah.
Now, to me, that's so stupid that it's comical. Because of course you can't know everything. Of course, obviously. But the idea in his mind was that to even try is silly or pointless or something. Well, I don't think so, of course. I'm not one of those people that thinks there's anything wrong with knowledge. You can't have too much knowledge. You can't be over-educated. There's no such thing. But to abandon the attempt to accrue knowledge you're a child then.
It's like
you
saying
will remain a child.
It's like saying that just because we're not going to live forever, why bother living?
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah, you can't eat all the food in the world, so why bother eating anything ever? I mean, yeah, it's
I think there's a sort of laziness there.
Oh, yeah, of course. Oh, it's absolutely born out of laziness.
Yes. But the question is, though, whether this kind of there are layers of laziness and whether thinking that we're infallible is a form of laziness, and whether, because it basically tells us that there is no improvement that we're capable of. There's no reason for improvement in the first place. We know already everything. Mm. We view things from God's eye perspective. And that's completely wrong. And it seems to me that these people, if they are going to talk about history every now and then, they will be completely uncritical and non-cognizant of the fact that, you know, the things you're reading were written by people. And we have very few accounts of history, especially the further back we go. And this means that, you know, all we have is fragments and texts. But these things, not only, but this is a lot of it. We also have, obviously, you know, we have fossils.
Archaeology.
We have archaeology, yeah. We have objects, yes. But what I wanted to say specifically about accounts of events and historiography was that we have the problem of interpretation, that when we have texts, they frequently can be interpreted in all sorts of ways. And this has to do with, this isn't immediately obvious to someone who hasn't pondered on it, but it's good if we think of understanding. So let's say we open a book and we read the first sentence. We don't have enough to understand what is going on. In order to understand, so in order to gain an understanding of the sentence or a better understanding of the sentence, we have to read a bit more. We have to situate it in a paragraph. And then that paragraph in a chapter, that chapter in a book, that book possibly in a series of books. And especially with history, we have a lot of different people who give accounts of different things. So we have this problem to the nth degree, as you said. So it's really important to constantly bear in mind that we are fallible, and also that people who wrote history were fallible as well. Mm. And not only fallible, but some of them, they had specific motivations to write accounts in a particular way that, for instance, served their own interest, whether that took the form of, let's say, serving a particular regime or not.
Or any number of things.
Yes.
One of the first things you get taught, or I was at undergrad, about history is, who is the person that's saying this thing? Or, you know, who is it? Whether it's an ancient historian like Tacitus or someone,
yeah,
or if it's someone modern like Hugh Trevor Roper or someone. Who are they? What's their life? What's their motivation? What did they say about other things? What were their politics? All sorts of stuff. It gets very murky very quickly.
Yes.
And it's where history is just obviously so much more of a humanities subject than a science. It's much more like English literature in the sense that it's textual analysis.
Yes.
It's like you're deconstructing a poem or something. It's not just a science. And I think that, well, there has been, for a few hundred years now, an attempt to make history a science or a social science or something. And that it's possible to reduce it to some sort of level of mathematical proof or something, and that you can extrapolate from that the future.
Yes.
So that's the key thing. One thing I'll quickly say about that is that, in my opinion, and I've seen lots of other people say this, that historians, a good historian, are often some of the best people to make futurists, people that predict the future, futurist.
Yeah.
Because if you have a very good understanding of the past, you're much more likely to be able to sort of peer into possible futures. I think that's the case. One historian, I can't remember who it was now, I remember saying that, imagine it, you're sitting on the back of an open back lorry, looking out the back doors, or the open back of a canvas-covered, like a troop carrier-type vehicle. And as it's going along, you're looking backwards.
Yeah.
You can see the road and everything as it passes you by and goes off into the distance. And now if you're careful, if you sort of watch that long enough, you can make predictions. You know, like if I see a sign for a station, then probably the next thing that comes along will be a station, for example. Not always, but quite often. And you'll see patterns. And those patterns won't always be, well, quite often won't work, but sometimes will.
Yeah.
And that's the best you can hope for, to be able to see into the future. Well, some historians, people like Karl Marx even, have said, no, we can know with certainty. We know history well enough now, or I understand history perfectly enough to tell you what is going to happen in the future.
Yes.
Well, for me, they've overstepped the mark for a lot of people. They're wrong in that.
I think that one of the best things to do in order to dispel the sort of, or in order to counter the spell that these views of history have, is to focus precisely on the methodology.
Okay.
Because the whole point it boils down to is, especially when people make predictions about the future, why do you feel that certain about it? That's where the challenge lies to them. Because it's one thing to say, I am reading history, I'm observing people around me, I'm understanding myself, I'm understanding other people, I am equipped to make good, informed judgments about what is probably likely to happen. That's one thing. It's quite another thing to say, no, I'm absolutely certain that this will happen, like you're a prophet. And especially when we're talking about large-scale events, not like I'm certain that I will die, I'm certain that, you know, the whole civilization is going to turn out this way. So for me, that this is one of the issues that lie, for instance, that is wrong under the Marxist interpretation of history. And not only that, but it seems to me that there is a claim to certainty that is unwarranted.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
That's the point, that it's one thing to say that you have read all of history, and that you have, for instance, detected patterns, and you think that something is very likely to happen, and quite another to say that I am 100% certain that it will happen. And I think that one of the problems that come into this is that there's an insufficient appreciation of methodology, especially there's an insufficient appreciation of David Hume's work, especially the formulation he gave to the problem of induction. And this is really important to bear in mind, especially when we're talking about large-scale physical events and social events, is that you may have observed a generalization over and over and over again. This doesn't give you the, let's say, warrant, the epistemic warrant, to say that it will happen again. And he gives a famous example. I'm going to give it again. About white swans. He said, before the British went to Australia, there was no black swan seen. They had not seen a black swan before. So he said that someone who was in Britain would detect the pattern that all swans are white. Even if, he says, all the data that you encounter confirm a generalization, an empirical generalization, this doesn't give you the warrant that this is always going to be the case. Mm. And this is a problem that many people in philosophy of science. Scientists, of course, say that induction is basically all we have when we are examining the universe, for instance, almost all we have. Mm. You could say that there are some other methods that have some rationalistic bits, but induction is indispensable. Mm. But there are different ways of thinking. That is why we hear people say, well, this is what our best theory entails, rather than this is absolutely the case and this is what happens. Because, for instance, the observable universe is not the entirety of the universe. So it's in the same way, in principle, in the same way that the British had never seen a black swan before they went to Australia, and that could never warrant the claim that therefore all swans are white. But the problem is that even if all swans were white, it could, would still be a problem, because it would be something that you have no data to confirm it. So you could say it could be the case that all swans were white, but just from sense experience of swans, you could never say that, therefore, all swans, I'm dead certain that all swans are white. Mm.
Absolute yes. certainty. Right, yeah.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.